The Church of God, the Eternal, presents Balance versus Compromise, a message given by Mr. John Brisby in Eugene, Oregon, March 4th, 2023.
Many times, God's people face problems in knowing or reconciling how to make correct decisions under pressure. There's a lot of way to make mistakes. Now, any one of us can and will make mistakes in judgment. But one of the biggest challenges, I would say, and the thing that I would like to put a spotlight upon is an orientation of mine in concerning this issue of God's laws and His commandments versus personal judgments. Because there are some who want to say, you know, that everything is black and white. In other words, they would love to pigeonhole everything that comes up and every decision that has to be made as an issue of either keeping God's commandment or violating God's commandment. And that's the principle that I'm challenging today. Yeah, there are some who will always say that every choice is black and white, and therefore they see everything in terms of either making the right decision or the wrong decision according to the law. But many times, my assertion to you today is, many times those choices are not truly about right and wrong, but they require the use of wisdom in order to find the best response. And so my hypothesis is that if everything is black and white, it's either right or wrong, so you should know to do the right and not to do the wrong, then where does wisdom come in? Where is the principle of wisdom if everything is black and white? Oh, now some are going to say, oh, so you're going to justify, you know, violating God's law on the basis of making judgments. No, I'm not. In fact, the title that I've given for this sermon is Balance versus Compromise. Balance versus Compromise. Our church has been full of examples over many decades of zealous members who, in essence, want to make the right choices in their personal lives, but have a history of making foolish choices in the name of, quote, obeying God. That's just a fact. And so I'm going to also assert to you, I've got a lot of concepts I want to fit into this, and I've got them all written down in my notes, and I'm not sure how it's going to come out. So to a certain extent, I'm not winging this. I'm going to give you a lot of biblical text in it, but I'm not sure about the order per se. So let me tell you, for the most part, we believe that God has called not the wise of the world, but the foolish. Isn't that what the New Testament tells us? He called the weak and the base to confound the mighty. Not in all cases. There are a few smart, high IQ, you know, highly educated individuals that make their way into God's church by His calling. But for the most part, God has revealed in the Bible that that's not who He's chosen to make a part of the church. So if you're a member of the true church of God, odds are you're not the sharpest pencil in the box, naturally. And I'm not saying that to diss anybody. But from a starting point on how we think about ourselves, it behooves us to think about ourselves not as having this great natural wisdom and cleverness that allows us to discern and to make good decisions under pressure. If that's how you're viewing yourself, you are in great danger of making serious mistakes, more than you need to make. If you come from a humble position, however, and assume that maybe by nature you lack some of the natural skills extend in the world by some of the truly smart, I think you're in a better position to actually make good choices. Why? Because you have access to God's wisdom. That's why. You have access to God's wisdom. Yes, our church has been full of individuals who have been very zealous for the truth, and I've seen them make horrible choices personally. So I'm not talking about compromising God's law outwardly. I'm talking about making what I'm going to call foolish decisions personally. Not an issue of right or wrong. And what I would love to do is impart a challenge and an inspiration to all of you under the hearing of my voice around the world that would put you in a position to take advantage of the wisdom that God offers you. Because you can make better choices, even personally, if you have the right orientation of mind. But what I've seen a lot in my history of growing up in God's church and being in God's church for many, many decades is individuals who go to extremes. So the reason I put the word balance in the title, and again, no, I'm not talking about compromising the law and justifying compromise under balance. I'm talking about when it's not an issue of right or wrong according to God's commandments, then using moderation and balance in how you evaluate circumstances and make personal choices. That's what I'm advocating. Now, to start off, what is compromise? Let me give you a few biblical examples of absolute compromise of God's law. All right, let's start in Numbers 20, verse 7, and this is, we're going to pick on Moses. Well, God had, you know, this recorded as an example for you and me. And in reading verses 7 through 12 of Numbers 20 very quickly, here's one of the several mistakes the Bible says that Moses made. Now, Moses, the New Testament confirms that Moses fulfilled God's will. And yet here's a chronicle of one of his mistakes, beginning in verse 7. The Eternal spake unto Moses, saying, take the rod, and gather thou the assembly together, thou and Aaron thy brother, and speak ye unto the rock before their eyes. And it shall give forth his water, and thou shalt bring forth to them water out of the rock, so thou shalt give the congregation their beast drink. And Moses took the rod from before the Eternal, as he commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the congregation together before the rock. And he said unto them, because Moses was incredibly frustrated with these rebellious Israelites who continued to murmur and to murmur and to murmur, and they would never, ever give God the benefit of the doubt, which is what got him into this situation. But in his state of frustration, what did he do? He said, verse 10, Moses and Aaron gathered the congregation together at the rock, and he said unto them, hear now, you rebels, must we fetch you water out of this rock? And Moses lifted up his hand, and with his rod he smote the rock twice, and the water came out. So God backed him up in his office now as a judge and the leader physically of Israel. God backed up Moses, but Moses didn't do what God told him to do. God said, speak to the rock, and he would create this miracle. Moses instead used his rod and struck the rock. The Eternal spake unto Moses and Aaron, because you believed me not to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this congregation into the land which I have given them. Now, again, it wasn't because God was being hard-hearted and looking for a reason to keep Moses out of the promised land. Mr. Raymond Cole certified for us, Moses physically represented flesh, and flesh does not enter into the kingdom. So Joshua was going to be the one who signified or symbolized Jesus Christ. So Moses led them through the wilderness, but was buried by God on that side of the Jordan and did not enter in. That, not because he made some egregious mistake that God would not forgive. So that's a different topic. But what I'm pointing out here, this is an example of a compromise of God's instruction. This isn't an issue of personal judgment where either one of them would have been technically okay, i.e. not a sin. But this was where Moses made a mistake, which was a violation of what God told him to do. That's compromise. It wasn't his intention to be rebellious, but in the heat of the moment, he compromised God's instruction. God said, speak to the rock. He struck the rock. Okay, so there's compromise. What's another one? 1 Samuel 15. poor old King Saul. He just couldn't learn his lesson. He, you know, had several different instances. This was actually in 1 Samuel 15, verse 20, is the second time he was guilty of not following God's specific instructions. Very quickly, 1 Samuel 15:20. Saul said unto Samuel, this was after now God gave them this Israel this great victory under Saul against his enemies, but God through Samuel had told him ahead of time, when I give you this victory, I want you to kill man, woman, and beast. Don't take any of the booty. I want you to destroy it all. And Saul didn't do it. So Samuel comes and meets with him in verse 20. And Saul said unto Samuel, yea, I've obeyed the voice of the Lord. I've been obedient. I did what God told me to do. And have gone the way which the Eternal sent me, and have brought Agag, the king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. So I guess he wanted a pat on the back. Verse 21, but now see, Saul is having to clarify. But, verse 21, the people took of the spoil, sheep, oxen, the chief things, which should have been utterly destroyed. So he acknowledges God said, destroy it all. And he's telling Samuel the story now. Well, I know I was supposed to make sure all this got destroyed, but the people, you see, they took of it to sacrifice unto the Eternal, thy God, in Gilgal. So there was a good purpose, not because we wanted to keep it or they wanted to keep it for their personal enrichment. They wanted to take some of this material booty and turn it into an offering for God. What's wrong with that? Verse 22, Samuel said, hath the Eternal as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, said Samuel, to obey is better than sacrifice. So these people who are out there wanting to, quote, serve God, make an offering to God, you know, in their religious works, but they're not doing it the way God said it, he doesn't seem to like that. The Bible's full of examples where he says, I want you to worship me the way I tell you to do it, not the way you think you want to worship me or show respect for me. He cares about the details. Anyway, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams. Verse 23, for rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as the iniquity of idolatry. So in essence, through Samuel, God was telling Saul, no, you're guilty of rebellion because I told you to do this and you did something different. There, my dear friends, is another clear example of compromise. Notice I'm not focusing on the Ten Commandments. Those are straight, well, I say they're straightforward. No, they're not, when people want to interpret what keeping and violating the commandments is all about. But I'm using other examples here to show you. Likewise, examples of violating an instruction of God, which is compromise versus obedience. So if God leads through whatever means to say do this and don't do that, and we do the opposite, that's compromising. That's not using a judgment where you have the option to do A or B, and neither one of them is a sin. So that's not really what I want to focus on today. But I'm showing you the contrast of what real compromise is versus balance. Because there are those who will want to say, oh, Brisby's, you know, justifying, you know, playing with the commandment keeping based upon situational ethics or whatever. No, I'm not. There are a lot of decisions that you make day to day that don't have to do with either violating or keeping the commandment. You have a choice, but there is wisdom in the choice you make versus foolishness in the choice that you make. And you can either help yourself or you can harm yourself based upon how you make those personal decisions. Another example of clear compromise, and it doesn't involve the commandments, King David. Won't turn to him, but you know from 2 Samuel 11 what's involved in that. The chronicle, number one, of David committing adultery with Bathsheba. She was the wife of another man. And then when she got pregnant, then he set up a conspiracy to kill her husband and took her as wife. Okay, so it started with adultery and turned into murder. All that's in 2 Samuel 11. That's a clear compromise of the law, isn't it? That's not just a poor judgment. That's a violation of God's law. Here's one from the New Testament, Galatians 2, verse 12. Here is one where the Apostle Peter got caught in a poor judgment, which wasn't just a poor judgment because ultimately it involved a violation of God's law. What was it? Well, and it's the Apostle Paul was inspired to chronicle it here in Galatians 2, beginning in verse 12. Paul says, "For before that certain came from James," what are we talking about? James was the apostle who had charge of the church in Jerusalem, which was dominated by Israelites, blood Israelites who then became members of the new Christian church, and James was the apostle over that church. So here are these Israelites who are members of the Christian church who are now visiting in a Gentile area. "For before that certain came from James," meaning these Israelites from Jerusalem, "and did eat with the Gentiles, but when they were come," he, talking about Peter, "withdrew and separated himself, fearing them which were of the circumcision." So Peter didn't have a problem with fellowshipping with, sharing a meal with, Gentile converts in the church. He knew that was just fine. But there were still a number of these Israelites who had a hang-up about it, about accepting non-Israelites into their fellowship, because they were raised with this idea that you segregate and you don't fellowship with Gentiles. So Peter made a judgment in this case, not to, antagonize these weak Israelites who would have probably flipped out had they seen him fellowshipping with Gentiles. So Peter made a judgment in this case to separate and stop fellowshipping with with some parts of the church in order to appease the weak conscience of these Israelites. Was that just a judgment that involved neither right nor wrong, but just a personal decision? No. It was actually wrong. Peter didn't mean to do it, but that's what he ended up doing under pressure. Verse 13, let's keep reading. "The other Jews dissembled likewise with him." So they followed Peter's lead and withdrew their fellowship with these other members of the church based upon physical birth. "Insomuch that Barnabas also was carried away with their dissimulation." He was one of the main teachers. Paul says, "But when I saw that they walked not uprightly according to the truth of the gospel." So what Paul is clarifying here is this wasn't just a poor judgment, this was a sin. Because what Peter did under pressure to try to make an appeasement was a violation of God's law. Because in God's church, there is no separation based upon Jew or Gentile. But that transition period was very difficult in the first century. And Peter fell into the trap of making a wrong choice, which wasn't just a foolish decision, but it actually implied then what he was doing by making that action was actually inadvertently teaching a wrong doctrine. And Paul called him out on it respectfully. He says, "When I saw that they walked not uprightly according to the truth of the gospel, I said unto Peter before all, if thou being a Jew livest after the manner of Gentiles and not as does the Jews," meaning you recognize the first covenant is done away. All the sacrifices and the washings and also these prohibitions against fellowshipping with other Christian converts who came out of the Gentile world. You know that first covenant is done away. You don't have a problem with it. So why are you still pandering to this? Why compel some of the Gentiles to live as do the Jews? So Paul respectfully called him out because it was an issue of doctrine. So I use that as an example with the example of the mistake of Moses, the mistake of Saul, the mistake of King David. There's examples of compromise. Compromise is not justified. Those are choices that have to do with either being right before God or being wrong in the eyes of God, i.e. committing sin. So when I'm talking about balance, I'm not talking about justifying compromise of God's law in order to solve a problem. What am I talking about? What is an action that I'm going to say falls under balance by comparison, which is not compromise? In general, balance often includes avoiding going to extremes. Again, not when there's a right or wrong question at stake, but when there's a judgment involved personally. You have the prerogative to take a different action, one or the other. How will you make your judgments? Will you either manifest wisdom in your personal decisions or foolishness? What are some examples? There are many. What have I seen in the church that I would say fall under the category of a lack of balance? Well, and they can involve doctrine. When people in the church zealously assume that they understand what God requires, like in keeping the Sabbath, and they're wrong because it's not the faith once delivered, but they're going to go overboard, like the ones who aren't going to turn on their stove on the Sabbath because that would be lighting a fire. No, that's not what we were taught. So is it wrong to keep your stove off on the Sabbath? No, you won't be committing a sin if you eat cold food only on the Sabbath. But that's a foolish choice because that's not within the principle that Jesus Christ gave, because Jesus Christ said the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. The servant, we believe, was God's inspired apostle of our age, Mr. Herbert Armstrong, taught us the right way to make these decisions and to clarify. Okay? But there are some people who get it in their head and then they think, so you can go to extremes if you want to and can be safe and not violating the Sabbath. I would tell you you are in danger, however, of violating the spiritual principle if you're rejecting the faith once delivered and leaning to your own understanding. So there's can put you in danger in that case of violating the law of God if you're rejecting the inspiration that Jesus Christ gave to his true church. Because you've got your own interpretation of it. But I'm not going that far with it. I just want to say there are people in the church who have been famous over many years for zealously doing certain things which are not necessary. They don't practice balance. They run to extremes. There are some who have a problem within like cutting themselves off from the world. No, we're not supposed to be a part of the world. We're not supposed to be absorbed by the world. We're supposed to come out of the world. But as Jesus Christ prayed to his Father before he was crucified, I pray not that you take them out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil. We have to live in this physical world, and part of our training program is making good choices, having to interface our jobs, you know, to whatever extent. We do exist in the physical world, and we do have interchanges with people in the world. So some have a tendency to think they're going to like go off somewhere and live in a cave and isolate themselves from all worldly influences, and that somehow is going to make them better off. No, it's not. No, it's not. Now, the opposite extreme to that is those who want to get as close to the world and absorb as much of the world as they possibly can and still feel like they're not violating God's law. But the closer you dance to the edge, the more likely you are to step over and fall off the cliff. So again, balance. We're talking about not going to extremes in the way you're making your personal decisions and how you fulfill God's command to come out of the world and yet not turn yourself into a hermit and go, you know, absolutely to the opposite ridiculous extreme. What else? Just some examples. There's some who are super sensitive about others in the church and are less tolerant of their weaknesses and like to interpret that somebody's guilty of heresy when they're not. In other words, they're super sensitive about heresy. Heresy is the intentional proclamation of a false doctrine in an attempt to encourage others in the flock to embrace false doctrine in opposition to the truth. That's heresy. A lot of what we face with problems and weaknesses within brethren in the church is not heresy, it's just personal weakness. And those are the cases where we are commanded to show long-suffering, patience, kindness, to cover rather than to expose. So I would say a lot of mistakes happen with poor judgment in assessing what you're dealing with when you're interfacing with other people. And I've seen it, you know, to the detriment where people withdraw their fellowship with certain ones that they treat as if they're heretics, and they're not. Well, that can be deadly, by the way. That does violate a spiritual principle when you make a poor judgment like that. So I would say be very, very careful. The other extreme is possible too. There are ones who are willing or have been willing to coddle true heretics. Ones who are representing and seeking to foster false doctrines in opposition to what we were taught is the truth in an underground kind of an environment within the church. That you need to be able to identify and absolute avoid. So there are judgments that certainly involve God looking at what you do as either sin or not sin. But as what I'm trying to emphasize is the fact that a lot of these things happen in a gray, murky environment where it's not easy to tell the right from wrong. This is where wisdom comes in. Judgment is required in order to make a good choice. It's not black and white, meaning easy to tell in all cases. So I remember Mr. Cole years ago talking about the number of ones he dealt with who wanted to treat every issue that came up as if it was black and white and should be simple. And especially those who wanted to advise him how he should do his job as a minister, especially involving the problems of certain other members of the church. Well, you shouldn't let this person stay in the church because they're clearly doing this, black and white, therefore you should put them out. Or whatever, or here's another one, you, Mr. Cole, should be able to make decisions on marital status, divorce and remarriage type situations, because here, I've written out this formula. If the wife or the husband did this, and they married this, and this happened, and then just follow this decision tree, and you should be able to tell they're either married, they're not married, they stay in the church, or if they won't separate, you put them out. I remember Mr. Cole, you know, exasperated at those individuals who wanted to simplify everything and say everything is straightforward, and therefore he should be able to make a black and white decision. Yes or no, thumbs up, thumbs down. So those are individuals who lack the capacity to recognize their own limitations, one, in making judgment, or recognizing that there are things that we do not know. Because just for instance, I'm not trying to run down that rabbit hole, in DNR situations, the intents of heart go into whether there was ever fraud involved in original marriage or not. And if you can't read hearts and minds, you can't judge it. God knows. The individuals involved are the only ones who know, and God. A minister doesn't know, which is why Mr. Cole wisely refused to get involved with making those judgments. They always sort out in the end, by the way, because if somebody's violating that, if they're lying to themselves or lying to the rest of us about their marital state, but they're actually committing adultery, sooner or later, the fruits in the life of that person will manifest itself. And they did. And we used to have a lot of couples like that in the church. And they ultimately left for other reasons, not because Raymond Cole put them out. Who made the wise choice? Raymond Cole did. One of the many instances of his wisdom in administration that I came to admire greatly, which is why he became a mentor to me. Because I saw the value in the way he thought about the application of God's immutable law, but also understood the murky gray aspects of being able to make judgments in the real world day by day. And he understood his own limitations of authority, let alone capacity to understand and discern. We make a lot of our foolish decisions because we do not recognize our own physical limitations. We assume we have greater powers than we do. Another examples of what I would say are unwise or foolish choices. There are those who have come into the church, oh, well, I'm going to live in faith, so I'm not going to plan anything for my future. I'm going to live day by day. I'm not going to save any money. God will provide. God wants us to, you know, depend on Him for our daily bread. So they never save, and they assume this is Christian. This is what God wants them to do. No, it's not. It's stupid. If you have the capacity, you know, any one of us might be in a situation where we have no choice but to live day by day. But if you have more, if God is providing you more than your daily bread, you have an obligation to manage it wisely as a good steward. And I've seen a lot of people in God's church who make really poor decisions about how they manage their physical blessings. So, do we have opportunities for growth and learning and accomplishment? Yes. Why? Because you're the called people of God and you have access to God's wisdom. You know, the people in the world are divided up between the clever and the foolish, and the lucky and the unlucky. And you put together a clever person with luck and they accomplish all these things. And there's some people in the world who just seem like they never get a break. They just walk around with a black cloud over their head and everything they touch never materializes. But I'm not talking to that audience. I'm talking to an audience of those who have been handpicked by God and called out of this world, which means you have an opportunity to come out of your foolishness. You have access to real wisdom because God's promised to give it to you if you'll accept it. So some, you know, make really bad choices financially or personally, foolish decisions for planning for the future, and any one of us will and have made poor choices. But there's a difference in making a poor choice but having a poor philosophy. Again, if you are inflicted with one of these wrong ways of thinking about your personal situation, and the requirement to use moderation and balance in assessing how you evaluate things and make judgments in your personal life, because you've got a wrong railroad track kind of an idea in your mind that guides every single thing you do, you know what you're going to do? You're going to make a foolish decision this time, and then the next time, you're going to make another foolish decision. And then you're going to follow up with another foolish decision because you never learn. How about using God's wisdom and breaking that cycle? That's what I'm admonishing all of us to do. There are some who always seem to be in a personal crisis. Now, some it might be because they're dealing with physical health problems or family. You know, there's certain things none of us can control. We are dealing with a situation truly that is beyond our control, and we have to make the best that we can with it. But there are some I have known in the church over many decades who are their own worst enemies, and they are the ones who dig the hole for themselves by foolish choices. And what's the old axiom, you know, of worldly wisdom? If you find yourself in a hole, stop digging. That's the first thing you should do, is stop digging. But see, it takes wisdom to know how to do that. People in the world, if they're naturally unwise, you can't expect them to do it. People in the church, that's different. You can. You don't have to be foolish. You can make your personal choices according to God's wisdom, and He will help you. Part of the package deal that He offers. 1 Peter 3, verse 15. A few texts I want to give you just to show that God recorded several texts which do reflect the reputation that God's people have in the world because of the way we deal with our personal responsibilities and deal with people in the world. Part of your witness, your light that you're shining, has to do with the way you interface on a lot of these personal choices that aren't a black and white about either violating or keeping God's law. They are manifestations to what extent that you can employ and are employing good judgment and wisdom. 1 Peter 3:15. Sanctify the Lord God in your hearts and be ready always to give an answer to every man that asks you a reason of hope that is in you with meekness and fear. That doesn't mean you're a missionary waiting for somebody to ask something about your religion so you can pounce on them and tell them all about your Sabbath and holy days and the plan of God. No, that too requires the wise, judicious words that you will use to address somebody who asks you, well, why are you dressed up on a Saturday? Or in the middle of a week during the Feast of Tabernacles, and what is this group you're a part of? Or why do you do this? Or why do you do that? So again, this isn't about, that's an example, not about right or wrong, is it? But there is judgment, there is wisdom or lack of wisdom, and how you craft your words to answer. These are the kind of things that I'm talking about. Verse 16, having a good conscience, that whereas they speak evil of you because they will not understand, they'll think you're part of a crazy cult religion doing strange things which are foolish because they don't understand. Having a good conscience that whereas they speak evil of you as of evildoers, in fact, especially the so-called Christians, the Protestants really hate us because they think we're trying to earn our salvation by keeping the law. And they consider that heresy. Whereas they speak evil of you as of evildoers, they may be ashamed that falsely accuse your good conduct in Christ. That you are actually manifesting an example in the world, in your interface with others, that one day, even if not now, but one day they will recognize and be able to hearken back to and say, I remember, I thought he was absolutely whacked. Now I recognize. He was actually setting a good example of respect for God. Is that how people will view what you and I are doing today? In the day that God calls them sometime in the future? Are you and I making good judgments in the way we speak to and interact with others in the world? Galatians 6, verse 9. Galatians 6, verse 9, let us not be weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap if we faint not. As we have therefore opportunity, let us do good unto all men, especially unto them who are of the household of faith. So especially those in the church, but by especially, it's including also people in the world, meaning we should set a good example of kindness, of respect, in how we deal with people in the world. Now that's harder for me to do. Because if I'm going to let down my guard, it's going to be with people in the world. So we have to be sure that we're keeping all of that in mind. And it's really easy to be hard and indifferent and dismissive to people in the world. Especially because there's a lot of people out there who are doing a lot of bad things, and they're actually looking for weaknesses to exploit. And I hate to be exploited. However, the example of Jesus Christ is to show kindness and mercy and long-suffering and patience. You know, simple respect, and that is harder and harder to find in the world because the world is becoming more crass, more rude, you know, more violent, more disrespectful. Just, you know, going by language. How much foul language do you hear? You know, I'm not going to say it goes with wearing tattoos, but, you know, there's a class of people, you know, there's a degeneracy that's going on in society that has to do with the dumbing down of everything, including manners. And so the proliferation of bad language, you know, it used to be just men, you know, and the women, you know, and you didn't use bad language around a woman. Now the women use it as much as the men. Every curse word in the book. And this is just all normal now, which means it's harder and harder if you're going to set a different example, but yet you're still going to show respect and courtesy to people rather than deal with them in a tit-for-tat fashion, which I'm more a tendency to do. So I have to overcome that. But these are all things that are part of the image that we create, not because we're putting on a false one, but again, Are we working on using wisdom instead of foolishness in what we say and how we behave ourselves in public and in dealing with others? Again, well, so you're going to say, well, yeah, that does involve either a right way or a wrong way. It's either black or it's white. But the subtlety of making those choices is not always easy for you and me to see. And that's my point. But let us do good unto all men. Treat them with respect, remembering you are ambassadors for Jesus Christ in all of your interactions, both within the church and outside of the church in your day-to-day interactions. Philippians 4, verse 5. Philippians 4, verse 5, let your moderation be known unto all men. Now, how are you going to do that? Let your moderation be known unto all men. So when you make a decision which is considered moderate, you should raise your hand and say, hey, everybody, I just want you to see how moderate I was here, because I'm supposed to let you know. No. Your moderation becomes known to other people because they see you in action. Like, and how much you drink in public, or how much you do anything. Do you show self-restraint? Do you put a restraint on yourself that other people in the world are more likely not to? Do you have a reputation of being moderate or not? It's a lot of things that people are going to look at decisions that you make when you may not even be thinking about it. But people are drawing conclusions based upon what they see you do or don't do. Are you a moderate person? How do other people view you, not how you might view yourself? How do other people view you? Are you considered a restrained individual? Or do you have a reputation of unrestraint? Let your moderation be known unto all men. The Lord is at hand. Yeah, he's evaluating everything. In that regard, he's making a decision of good versus evil, righteousness versus sin. But again, I'm talking about decisions that you and I make where that may be fuzzy. There's judgment involved. But again, what's a wise person going to do? A wise person, when in doubt, you know, make one decision as opposed to another decision. The application of moderation. 1 Peter 2, verse 20, I'm just giving you a smattering of a lot of different of these texts to emphasize the overall principle. 1 Peter 2, verse 20, for what glory is it if when you be buffeted for your faults, you shall take it patiently? How many times I've seen this in the church? God's people suffer, quote, persecution, but it's not persecution they really needed to endure. It's persecution they brought on themselves because of making a foolish choice. But it's, oh, woe is me, I'm being persecuted for righteousness' sake. No, you're not. You made a bad choice personally, and you paid the price for it. Didn't have to happen that way. And we are all guilty of that at times. Is that an exception to the rule, or is that a normal mode for us? That's the question. What glory is it when you are buffeted for your faults? Meaning you got yourself into that pickle. You take it patiently. Well, good. If you make a mistake and you bring some persecution upon yourself and then you respond correctly and take it patiently, that's better than if you dig the hole deeper by responding in a volatile fashion. But again, one of the axioms I learned way back in my corporate world was, don't expect to be rewarded for solving a problem that you created. Don't expect to be rewarded for solving a problem that you created. So again, this is where wisdom comes into play. The ability by using the mind of Christ and his Holy Spirit to help you to recognize and to make better choices under pressure, to avoid digging holes deeper than are required. But if, when you do well, now if you're really obeying God's laws physically and spiritually, and you suffer because you are persecuted for your beliefs, and you suffer for it You take it patiently. This is acceptable with God. Yes, you may suffer because of righteousness' sake, because you would not violate the Sabbath, because you brought persecution from your family, because you wouldn't, you know, go to a Christmas celebration or involve, you know, send somebody a birthday gift. That may be suffering for righteousness' sake. However, if you avoid reaching out to your unconverted family at other times, if you just don't ever give gifts, you don't do any outreach whatsoever to show kindness to them under the guise of, well, I don't keep Christmas and I don't keep birthdays and that's the only time they want to get together. Is there something else you could do, like send them a gift at another time of year to show an expression of love? And for some of your families, it won't make any difference, because if you don't send it on their birthday, you're persona non grata. But how many others actually could enhance those family relationships in the world if you went out of your way to show kindness at other times that didn't violate your religion, like Christmas and birthdays or whatever? Are there opportunities and wisdom to actually reach out and to improve those relationships? There are some in the church who are just oblivious to that. They just, oh, well, my religion doesn't allow me to do it, so I'm just cutting off my family. That's not wise. 1 Peter 4, verse 15. 1 Peter 4:15, but let none of you suffer as a murderer, as a thief, or as an evildoer. Those are clear violations of the Ten Commandments, right? Murder, theft, and other forms, you know, taking advantage of others. So don't violate the commandment. Or as a busybody in other men's matters. Now that's a little bit more subtle, isn't it? Because there's no commandment that says thou shalt not be a busybody. But here it is actually listed with these other commandments. Isn't it interesting? But how do you gain a reputation as a busybody? Or not? By the personal choices that you make and the interaction that you have with other people. So here takes some judgment, you see. Because on the one hand, if you will be liked and respected if you show an interest in other people rather than always want to talk about yourself. All right? But on the other extreme is being too inquisitive about other people and their personal business. You see that there is a balance here? And that going to extremes one way or the other, well, I don't want to be perceived as a busybody, so whenever I talk to somebody, I'll just talk about myself. That's an extreme. Okay? But I'm going to show this person how much I care about them. So how are things in your life? And what about this? 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 Oh, really? Okay, that's how you get to be a busybody in reputation. So here's a perfect opportunity for the use of balance. We're not talking about compromise of God's law. We're talking about using a judgment, what is wise and where's the limit to entering into foolishness and getting too much in somebody's other business versus just showing an interest. That takes, how do you know? It's not easy to know where the line is. That's why we need wisdom. Because it's not black and white. It's not black and white. Everything we're talking about is not black and white like some people would like it to be. It takes judgment. 1 Timothy 3, verse 1. 1 Timothy 3, I'll read verses 1 through 7. This is a true saying, if a man desire the office of a bishop. Now here we're talking about specific requirements in character for somebody who's going to be a minister in the church. However, it applies to us all. If a man desires the office of a bishop, he desires a good work. Bishop then must be blameless, husband of one wife, vigilant, sober, of good behavior. Well, who's going to evaluate that? What's good behavior? That's kind of a nebulous. Again, you're talking about reputation based upon how we each make our choices, not because we're ostentatious and we're trying to say, hey, look at me. But when you quietly make choices in your personal life, the people who know you will draw conclusions about the way you handle your personal lives and your responsibilities. people can see things that we do or don't do. So we create a reputation for ourselves, either positive or negative. Of good behavior, given to hospitality. Are you given to hospitality or are you a hermit? Do you pull yourself back? Or are you known for hospitality? Some of you, you're ill and, you know, it's all you can do just to, take care of your, and keep, you know, your households together, let alone entertaining or whatever. But to what extent do you entertain when you can? Do you show a desire and interest in fellowship? That's one thing that affects our reputation. Apt to teach. No, not apt to give people advice. But teaching, especially by personal example. There's no better way to teach others than just to let your light shine by the way that you harness yourself and make your own personal choices. Not given to wine, meaning, again, immoderate in physical things. No striker, so you're not one to lash out. What did you mean by that? And confront somebody. Always assume the worst. Not greedy of filthy lucre, but patient. Not a brawler, not covetous. One that rules well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity, not because he's a tyrant. Because there's wise administration of family responsibilities both for wives and husbands in those situations. Wisdom being used to take care of personal and family responsibilities. It makes all the difference in the world. So if he can't do those things, how shall he take care of the church of God? Not a novice, lest being lifted up with pride he fall into the condemnation of the devil. Verse 7, moreover, he must have a good report of them which are without, which is really why I wanted to focus on this passage. Do you think that your reputation in the world doesn't matter? This says otherwise. I'm not saying you're going out pandering like a politician to try and make people in the world like you. But what this is showing is, one, there is interaction with people in the world. You're not withdrawing yourself and trying to live in a cave. And in the interactions you do have with others in the world, you are creating a reputation. He must have a good report of them which are without. How? Because you're not pushing a religion on them. It must be in the way that you're making personal judgments, which are either wise, according to God's spiritual principles, or foolish. In the words that you speak, in the way that you resolve difficulties, disagreements, in the way that you interact, in the way that you're willing to lend a helping hand to help solve a problem, you have a reputation. What is it? So if all questions can be limited, it can put into either a black category or a white category. Well, according to God's law, it should be simple. Everything should be able to reduce to be doing a black, white, it's either right or it's wrong. That in and of itself is a foolish conclusion and ignores the need for the use of the principle of wisdom and judgment. If everything is black and white all the time, there is no use for wisdom. And yet the Bible is full of the admonition to get wisdom and knowledge. Notice Proverbs 4. I'm just going to give you, the book of Proverbs especially is filled with it. Let me just give you one here. Proverbs 4, verses 4 through 7. Wisdom is required by God of his people. Proverbs 4, verse 4. He taught me also and said unto me, let thine heart retain my words, keep my commandments. Okay, there's your black and white do's and don'ts. Keep my commandments and live, followed by verse 5, get wisdom and understanding. Get wisdom and understanding, forget it not. Neither decline from the words of my mouth, forsake her not, and she shall preserve thee, love her. Then basically giving a feminine entity to this concept of wisdom. Forsake her not. She shall preserve thee, love her, and she shall keep thee. Verse 7, wisdom is the principal thing. Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. and with all thy getting, get understanding. This will make all the difference in your life. It's not just knowing the black and white list of the commandments. It's the ability to interpret the spirit of that law in the real world, in all of the gray and the murky circumstances when everything is not black and white. That's the trick. So those who see every decision as black and white are excluding wisdom. And they are some of the ones who violate this principle the most. They make egregious mistakes because they're trying to be, they end up being like a bull in a china shop, and they ignore the subtleties of making judgments in a situation. James 3, verse 13. James 3, 13. Who is a wise man? Yeah, who indeed? Who is a wise man and endued with knowledge among you? What's the proof of it? Let him show out of good conduct his works with meekness of wisdom. One, they have a meek and a humble orientation of mind. And then, because they're actually humbly seeking God's guidance and using God's inspiration, they are more inclined to make good choices under pressure and gain a reputation for that. You know, one of the things I would say, one of my greatest blessings, one of my many greatest blessings in life, I have had good mentors. I had parents who taught me and showed me a good example of what to do and what not to do. That was huge. And then in my young life, I also had several teachers, even in public school, who I look back on and say, these people actually helped me. Hard to say, you know, in the world today. But in my life, it did make a difference. And then I had the privilege and the opportunity in my early work life to have certain mentors in the job, older people in the company who I gravitated to and kind of took me under their wing, and I learned a lot from them. So I had the opportunity. Many do not have that. Many are raised in an environment where they really don't have good examples. I ended up having a lot, which means I don't have an excuse for messing up. That's the way I view it. And I'm not saying that I learned and applied myself in everything that I should have learned by the mentors who showed me the right way. But I have a lot of things that I remember because I had good examples in my life along the way. And it made a lot of difference. And ultimately, Raymond Cole became my greatest mentor physically from age 19 and beyond. So I had examples to see what I believe was wisdom in action, in a way of thinking about problems and situations and making personal judgments in a positive way that actually produced good results as opposed to negative results. I had a lot of opportunity to see good results. I've also known many in God's church who see themselves as teachers, as if they're the font of wisdom, and yet the results of their choices are pretty dismal. I'm not trying to pick on anybody, I'm just trying to say that if you think you're a source, that people should listen to you and look to you as a source, you know, for knowing how to do things, what are your fruits? What have you accomplished? I'm not saying how much money do you have, I'm saying what is your reputation and what have you accomplished on this list of the things we've already read? Do you have a reputation in the world, let alone in the church, for being wise and judicious, being merciful and creating peace, of being moderate and establishing yourself as an example, a quiet example of respect for God's law and seeking positive outcomes in murky circumstances? Or is your reputation something else? The one I hate to see the most are the ones who always are able to point a finger at why somebody else is at fault, but they're always in the middle of it. They're always in the midst of a confrontation of some kind, but always able to show why it's not my fault. If you're constantly in the middle of problems, you need to turn the mirror on yourself and say, why is that true? Because it very likely is not because you want to be or you're trying to be, but what I would tell you you're likely doing is you're missing your own responsibility. You're not seeing yourself. You're making bad choices in what you say and what you do under certain circumstances and bringing problems upon yourself that don't need to be. Who is a wise man and endued with knowledge? Let him show out of a good conduct his works with meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and strife in your hearts, so that's the first thing you can do. Look at your own heart. What's in your heart? Are you eaten up with volatile feelings, negativity toward other people? Why? Well, I wouldn't be negative if they hadn't done... No. If you're being eaten up by negative feelings, that's your fault. Because the Spirit of Jesus Christ in you is one of peace and forgiveness and long-suffering and patience. So don't blame it on somebody else if you're in crisis internally. That's on you. If you have bitter envy and strife in your heart, glory not. Don't justify yourself and point the finger somewhere else and lie not against the truth, because God knows. God knows the facts. It's hard for us to see it because it's not black and white from our perspective. It is murky. But we are easily in a position of making wrong judgments. Verse 15, this wisdom descends not from above. That didn't come from God, but is earthly, sensual, demonic, meaning it's carnal. Can you separate out the influences of your carnal mind versus the influence of God's Spirit? For where envy and strife is, there's confusion and every evil work. The fruit of it is evident. But the wisdom that's from above. Now, you want to be a part of God's manifestation of real wisdom like we're talking about in the book of Proverbs? The wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, easy to be entreated, full of mercy, and good fruits, meaning good outcomes. No, you can't control the outcome when you're dealing with other people because it takes two to tango. But is your participation in a personal interaction, a confrontation, disagreement, or whatever it is your participation one that soothes and helps mollify to create peace, or is your influence like throwing gasoline on it? Peaceable, gentle, easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality. And we are all guilty of partiality. We will defend our friends and we will vilify ones who aren't our friends, regardless of what the facts are. Without partiality and without hypocrisy. And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace. Are you known as a peacemaker? Again, I'm not talking about violating God's law to create a false sense of peace, like being willing to violate the Sabbath, or eat pork with somebody just so they won't be mad at you for not eating their dinner. I'm not talking about violate. That's compromise of the law. I'm talking about when you're not dealing with a clear black and white case of compromise, but you're having to make a personal judgment in how you deal with a situation. Can you? More times than not, can you make decisions that make better outcomes rather than worse outcomes? As I mentioned at the beginning, God didn't call very many who have natural wisdom. If you're in God's church, it's probably because you're not the sharpest pencil in the box. Why? Because God wants to show the power of His intervention in a life so that when you and I actually manifest wisdom, God will get the credit for it. Not, yeah, I'm not surprised. You know, that person has always been smarter than everybody else and more wise and gifted, so I'm not surprised they've done so well. You see, that wouldn't give glory to God. But when He can take people who by nature are foolish and then through the power of His Holy Spirit turn them into wise, People look at that and say, I can't believe he or she has accomplished what they have. Because you know, they weren't the smartest or the brightest. But look what they've accomplished. Now that stands out. And then God gets the credit for it based on your religion. Is that the example you're showing to others in the church and in the world? Manifestation of wisdom in judgments. Where will you get this wisdom? From your own personal notions? Some think so. They think they're naturally gifted. And they're willing to make their own personal choices and advice to others according to their idea about things. And yet the fruit of what they've accomplished tells a different story. So I would say, look at the fruits. Look at the fruits. God's law is the foundation of all wisdom, but then judgments must be made using the spirit of the law as a guide. Have you ever wondered why the Old Testament is full of comments about commandments, statutes, and judgments? And do you know the difference in all of those? The commandments are the base laws, the black and white that tells you the principle in its most simplistic fashion. Statutes expand upon each one of those commandments. So you've got a commandment that says, thou shalt not commit adultery. But what does that include? Is that just married people? No, it includes unmarried people. So the statutes actually show the expansion of the seventh commandment about what God really includes when he's talking about that base commandment. Well, what's judgments? We've got commandments, we've got statutes, and we've got judgment. What are the judgments? The judgments have to do with the ability to discern and make right individual decisions in an individual case according to the commandment and the statute. That's what we have in our court system today, too. That's why you have judges. That's why God commanded judges in Israel to weigh difficult situations when there was a dispute about how to apply the law. Because it's not always easy to know what were the facts in a situation. What are the nuances? King Solomon was famous for his wisdom and his ability to sift out and to make determinations because God gave him a special gift in that regard. So those who want to say, well, everything should just be black and white, they eliminate the need for judgments, weighing and making decisions when it's murky and not evident how to apply the unyielding law of God. We're not talking about compromise of God's law. We're talking about learning to make good judgments under pressure. So where are you going to get that? As I've said, one true evidence of God's spirit is the application of real wisdom in difficult moments. That's where it's really going to shine. Not how you and I make decisions in good times, but especially what we do under pressure and the ability to make right choices when we're more inclined to make wrong ones. And yet by the power of God's Spirit in you, you're able to see through, recognize the things that are most important, and make a wise application of a principle to make things better instead of making it worse. So not only to avoid compromising God's truth under pressure, but also to be able to avoid making things worse by making unwise choices that are unnecessary, that harm us. Don't make your life harder. Don't add persecution to yourself when it's not necessary because you're oblivious to these very principles about wisdom. So beware of falling into a trap of claiming that God is behind you because of your personal choices. Because after all, I'm a member of the church and I've been in the church for so many years and I have all this experience. I really don't care about that because I've seen a lot of longtime members of the church who make stupid choices and justify it because they have seniority. I've been attracted to adopting a mentor based upon their resume of years of experience. I look at the fruits of what they manifest in the way that they think and the way they make decisions under pressure. And I've tried to pick my mentors from individuals that do a better job of that and therefore help me. So I've just hit you with a shotgun full of a lot of these different principles that I hope they will at least pique your interest in that personal evaluation and evaluating more in your own personal Bible study about the application of good judgment and wisdom in the construct of the unyielding revealed law of God.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented Balance versus Compromise, a message given by Mr. John Brisby in Eugene, Oregon, March 4th, 2023.